Each failure is a step closer to success. You're listening to episode 10 of Learn With Us. I'm Ken.
And I'm Nikos. Learn With Us is a podcast for developers that want to be better programmers. Hey, Ken.
Hey, Nikos. So we've been up to a bunch of different things the last month and a half. I've been following you on LinkedIn. I haven't really chatted much, but I've been seeing a lot of things that you've been posting. What kind of things do you have coming up?
Well, I'm doing quite a lot of branding now. I'm trying to move more into sort of coaching, mentoring, you know, business seminars in regards to software and programming. So, yeah, it's kind of new for me. So in the next couple of months, I'll probably start having some more events in London.
Cool. I saw you have a webinar.
Oh, yeah, I'm doing a webinar on TypeScript and AWS, so I'm talking about the serverless framework. I gave a talk on that in London a few weeks ago. That was on a premises event, and now I'm just going to do the webinar with this company that I'm going to probably do some more events with, training events.
Cool, and is the webinar more of a hands-on type, showing how to actually get something up and running on AWS?
Yeah, so it's going to be quite a lot of different things in the webinar. First of all, I'm going to demonstrate what TypeScript is. I'm going to show what JavaScript TypeScript outputs on the TypeScript playground, and then I'm going to go into more complicated examples of TypeScript on running on my computer, and then comparing it to the compiled JavaScript, and then I'm going to cover serverless framework and a few minimum examples of TypeScript and serverless in action.
Cool. Anything else coming up?
I am trying to write more articles on LinkedIn. I'm just finding LinkedIn a great platform for networking. So I wrote an article yesterday on Big Bang versus incremental approach to software changes. And I'm also writing another article today on how great it is to live in London. I'm seeing London's like the Premier League of football when it comes to professional stuff.
Today's topic is going to be kind of centered around your Big Bang, incremental versus Big Bang article on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to kind of dive into that. If anybody wants to follow along, we'll have a link in the show notes.
Indeed, we will.
Essentially, the article is called Incremental versus Big Bang in Software. And Nikos, you kind of lay out what it looks like to make changes to your code base incrementally, or all, you know, kind of just a big swathing change of code. So let's dive in. What's the first thing that you cover in that blog post?
Well, I talk about my youth and how when I was a young developer, I had quite a lot of responsibilities in a company, and I decided that I wanted to make a new version of the software, and I made a lot of changes and a lot of refactoring, and I did it in more than one release, and chaos ensued for maybe a couple of weeks after that. So I tend to avoid doing that now, especially with the more bigger clients that I have. I try to tread very carefully. So there's like different aspects of this article that I go into. I focus on two just to make the article, you know, small enough to read in a few minutes. So there's linting, introducing linting into a project that doesn't have any, and also about, say, upgrading a framework that can sometimes be quite a big deal, and the incremental approach is good for both of them.
Yeah, linting is a good way. Like if you're just coming on to a project and you have no experience with it, linting is a great way to just get familiar. And with all the rules that are in the linting, it's kind of like a way for you to adjust your style to the project style.
Sure.
To make those changes, if you didn't have linting in a project and you wanted to start making changes to the project, yes, definitely add linting first, because then it kind of guides you as to where those changes need to be made.
Yeah. So if, say, you're in a team that has maybe 10 or more developers, say, for example, I was I created a refactoring ticket in Jira or whatever ticketing system you're using, and decided to just apply linting to all the files at once and then raise a pull request. I mentioned in the article that by the time your pull request is merged, it will be the end of the age of the universe, or until all the black holes have evaporated.
Yes, this is very true. Code review is quite a big issue when you're managing or when you're code reviewing. You tend to only want to code review and something that's going to take you just a cursory glance to kind of get the gist of what's going on. If you have to start evaluating thousands of lines of code in a code review, it's not likely that you're going to actually be that productive in reviewing it. So definitely doing incremental on that particular area is very important.
Yeah, and also the guy who merges it, if he's not the original pull request owner, then he's the one that's going to get the stick if he merges something that's big bang, you know, and it goes wrong.
Yes, that's true. There's going to be some project owner or something is going to be seeing who did all this code rework, and they're going to get blamed for it.
In GitHub, if you merge code changes, you don't appear as a person on the get blamed, do you? Or is it the original owner?
It depends on how GitHub is set up.
Yeah.
So GitHub can do, I think GitHub's actually just using standard Git features. So if you do a merge pull request, then you're going to get a, by default, GitHub used to just do a merge commit, which would then just bring all your changes in as they were committed.
Yeah.
But if you today you can do a rebase.
Right.
And there's another option I can't remember.
I think it's squash and merge or something.
So if you do a squash, you're definitely going to be on the hook for all of those commits.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be squashed into one commit. Granted, that squash merge message or memo will have the original commit information. However, I don't know if it'll have the original commit, like the committer, whoever committed.
I don't think it does.
I don't know if it'll reference that. So, yeah, if you do the squash, you might lose all reference to who did the work.
Yeah. If for linting, right, if you wanted to do the big bang, the only way I think you can do it is if you manage to pause all development and say, we're going to do the linting, nobody do the coding for the next hour. But I just don't see clients doing that. They don't have the nerve to do it. So that's why you've got to go incrementally.
Yeah, it's really hard. We've done that where I'm at now. Like, we had somebody go through and run the linter and did the fix, the dash dash fix on it.
Yeah.
Which did resolve a lot of the linting issues. We committed it, and now every time we go through a file and we look at like git blame on something, that user is referenced on all the lines of code, and you look at that commit, you go back and look at that commit, and you're like, what did they do? And you see all of the linting. So you can't even find out who originally wrote the line of code. Maybe it was a bad loop that was written. You have to kind of put on your detective hat and go dig into commit.
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to happen. There's no really way around that, is there? It's just kind of...
Yeah.
What happens?
Kind of the name of the game, I guess. Factoring due to linting is something that you should do incremental.
Yeah.
But it can be done in one big swath. I mean, I guess if I were to take over somebody else's project, if I was just a single developer and somebody gave me their project and I was the maintainer of an open source project, then I would just lint it and that would be my first commit to the project, and I'd just move on from there. When you're working with a team, it's definitely a lot harder.
Yeah. You almost need to handhold the people especially if they aren't used to the linting kind of stuff. You have to really kind of... But it's even harder if there's remote teams, you know. It's, like, tricky.
Yes, definitely.
So I also talk in the article about changing frameworks. There's certain frameworks you can sort of incrementally upgrade. There's some where... It just never happened, right? For example, we all know the Angular 1 horror story where when they moved to Angular 2, wasn't possible. But even well, with the later versions of Angular, when you upgrade the framework, then you should be able to do things incrementally. For Ember, for example, when you upgrade an Ember application, there's a lot of deprecations that can start firing. Deprecations are basically saying that this part of the framework is not going to be supported in a future version. So when you upgrade several versions at once, well, in Ember it's like it's a minor version. So from example, say 2.10 to 2.11, that would be considered an upgrading Ember. And between these upgrade versions, you could have deprecations thrown. Sometimes when you upgrade, you can get quite a lot of deprecations, and you have hundreds of them. And for that, I would also approach it incrementally.
I'm going to really date myself, but back in like the early 2000s, I started getting into PHP BB, which is a bulletin board software written in PHP.
Uh-huh.
And their upgrade path, and there was a lot of mods that you could apply to your code base, but you'd always apply them to the core software. So you'd never there was no like plugin directory that you'd put your plugins to. You'd actually go and modify the PHP BB core code. And this is before I was familiar with version control, and before a lot of the people in the community were familiar with version control. So we would go through the code base and sprinkle in our little modifications. And these could have been modifications that we found in the community, or these could have been our own custom modifications, and we might not have documented them. The incremental part of what Ember does is kind of like how we would treat the incremental part of upgrading, like a PHP BB, which we'd have to go through and find where we put our little special comment code that would, we had to search our code base and say, where did I put my comments so I know that where I have my little plugins dropped in. And then we'd have to take this PHP BB code base and apply our changes to the new code base. Everything's just like you have to walk through it. And especially in Ember's case, where you were to, say, jump a few versions ahead, those deprecation warnings that were in, so if you're in 1.0 and you went to 1.5, the deprecation warnings might have fallen out of the loop. I don't know how long they live in an Ember project, but
yeah, I think you just get they might errors.
Have fallen, you might have fallen, the deprecations might have fallen out of the framework, mm-hmm. and you won't see the deprecation. You might not even see any errors. You would only see errors during runtime.
I'm not sure about that with Ember. I need to double check with the guys who wrote it.
Yeah, I mean, Ember's done a lot, I think, in that area to make it more explicit.
Yeah.
So it might not be something that they need to worry about so much, but definitely the incremental stuff is good, because you'll never miss a piece that needs to be changed. And that's why, when they do release a new version, it might not be adding features that you care about. It might just have a small bug fix that maybe doesn't even pertain to you. But you should definitely think about upgrading as they come out. That'll help you be ahead of the game when it comes time to do that big 2.0 upgrade, if they end up going there.
Yeah. Well, the next one, Ember, is version 3, at some point.
Luckily with Ember, they seem to stick to the same principles, whereas in Angular's case, Angular 1 to Angular 2, there is an upgrade path, but it's not as cut and dry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, definitely, if you're moving from Angular 1 to Angular 2, you definitely have to think a bit harder about how things are going to go together.
Yeah, I don't think Google really recovered from that upgrade, because a lot of the work in London, most of the companies are asking for React.
Yeah, so there's still people on Angular 1. that have decided not to move with Angular 2, and Angular still maintains Angular 1. So it's not a bad framework, and I still enjoy it when I work in it. In fact, the company I'm at now, they have a team that has an Angular 1 application that's up and running. So they have no plans to move it to Angular 2. Or there's a lot of Angular 1 developers that have moved on to using Vue.
Oh, really?
yeah, so that's kind of the thing people are moving to. It's kind of got the best of both worlds in, as far as Angular 1 and React. So if you've got familiarity with either of those two frameworks, Vue might be something that you're interested in.
Yeah, I've actually kind of really settled down to Ember at the moment. I just find Ember so... Everything's there for you.
Yeah.
A lot of these other frameworks, there's like, you have to sort of figure out how you're going to do routing, how you're going to do data persistence and all this kind of stuff. With Ember, everything's just there. It's like, for example, imagine a lion on the top of the hill with all his food around him. Whenever he wants, he can just eat the food. All the other guys are the wolves at the bottom of the hill, trying to get up the hill to get the food. I don't know if it's a very good illustration, but when you want the food, it's there with Ember. Everything's been thought about.
That lion never gets bored. He's just like sitting up there on the hill, just chilling and eating. I mean, come on, you got to get up and do something. You got to go and explore the wilderness.
He's just watching all the other frameworks down below, trying to figure out how to do all the things that he already knows how to do, like testing, like data persistence, exceptions testing, configuration, build systems. I know Ember's very kind of like not that popular compared to the other ones, but there are some pretty big applications that are written with Ember. LinkedIn, for example, Twitch, yeah. PlayStation 4 Store, Apple Music Store.
No, I think Ember has its place, for sure.
Yeah.
What's the story on Ember and TypeScript? Can you successfully use the Ember CLI with a TypeScript code base?
Yeah, you can. I mean, I'm going to make a video on that probably pretty quite soon. Probably in the next week or so. I put it on my YouTube channel. So the way TypeScript works with Ember is that you'd install an add-in called Ember CLI TypeScript, and that then compiles the TypeScript files into the output JavaScript for the Ember build system. And you don't have to hardly think about what you're doing. It just does it for you automatically.
Cool. Yeah, I ran into that with the CLI a couple of years ago, and I didn't know how to get rid of Babel and then replace it with TypeScript.
Huh.
And maybe that's not what it's for. Maybe the Ember CLI TypeScript plugin transpiles TypeScript to ES6 or ES2015, and then the Ember CLI does the Babel transforms from there. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of clever stuff going on.
Sure.
If it works, let it work, and I'll just do the business logic. So how's work treating you these days?
Work is good. We're in the middle of rewriting adapting our code to work with a React world.
Oh, really?
So,
cool.
A lot of the commerce platform is switching to from Java server pages to React pages. So kind of interesting in a world where we depended on page loads to trigger our JavaScript to run. Now we have to be event-based, and then we have to expect that our React app is going to send us data that we know what users logged in, and we know what user or what country they're coming from, and stuff like that. So it's definitely it's a learning experience for the whole team, and we're just kind of making progress every day.
I mean, I'm enjoying being a bit of a free man for the next month or two.
Yeah, so did your contract end in August?
Yeah, just finished it actually. So it's like I've raised some children and they're off to do their own thing now, you know. That was quite satisfying, teaching and training.
Yeah, I'm sure whatever you taught and you took away some knowledge of how to do it differently or improve your course planning.
Well, it certainly helped me prepare courses and help my writing skills, mentoring skills, learning what management kind of things like. The management really likes this whole idea of incremental. They seem to catch on quite well. It goes down well with corporate clients.
Yeah. We had a discussion the other day about testing. And so we have this suite of tests that just kind of go through different parts of our code base.
Uh-huh.
And they in our code base we have files that all perform the same type of action, so they all have the same structure.
Uh-huh.
And so we have this suite of tests that just loop through all of these different files and apply the same test to them. And what we've discovered in doing this is the loop does not count towards our code coverage. And so when you have code coverage and you're like dependent on a certain threshold to be met, doing a loop is not a good approach towards it, because you're not explicitly calling the file and you're not explicitly targeting pieces of that file. And so the code coverage is not really that dynamic. It doesn't, our code is dynamic and it can read the test fine, mm-hmm. but the code coverage is not. So anyway, we had this discussion about, should we rip out these tests and write them explicitly for the files in which you're touching? And our product manager kind of said, no, we're not going to do that. Code coverage is not nearly as important as having the tests there right now. The tests are there right now, and they will throw errors if they do have if tests fail. So let's keep the code or the test there and not worry about code coverage so much.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So there is like a management thing to that, like the sanity of knowing that your tests are going to fail versus not having tests in the first place, because we don't know which files don't have explicit tests. We have to go and look for those. And having this kind of generic code testing mechanism is better than not having anything at all. So that was the argument of the product manager, and I think it's a good argument. But I don't know why they even put this in place in the first place. So whatever. My job is to focus on getting it out of there, and incrementally is the only way to do it.
Yeah, a lot of these types of scenarios I'm going to cover in some of my roundtable discussions. Kind of like basically hire a fancy room in a hotel, feed my clients, and then talk about soft skills and also like technical stuff.
That's great. I'm looking forward to hearing more about it. So where can they go to sign up for that webinar?
Well, the webinar, well, you can put the link on the sheet there. But these other events, I'm going to actually have an application on my website where people can apply to come to them. So I'm targeting executives, entrepreneurs, that kind of stuff, and they'll be like, I'll hire the hotel's media room, and I'll sit, 12 people, and we'll sit and have a 3-hour working lunch, and I'll give some presentations. For example, the first one I'm going to be doing is Secrets of Building World-Class Developer Teams. So I'll focus around 12 key areas and do training and teaching and workshop on that. And that'll be fun. That'll be sometime in October. All going well.
So I just went to quantumjs.com and I can see the Square roundtable.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe I could tell the hotel to saw off the ends and, you know, make a bit more square.
Rounded, you mean? Yeah.
That picture is actually the room we'll be using, and that is actually a television, believe it or not.
Oh, I thought it was a window. That's interesting because the window's on the left.
That's actually on Park Lane, and it's a 5-star hotel, and there'll be coffee and drinks and food basically on tap there. But that's where I'm going next, anyway.
Okay, well, we reached the end. This has been a fun talk.
Yep.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Learn With Us. And you can find us on Twitter for the 1 to 2 tweets per month, maybe, at Learn With Us Pod. Be sure to go to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. And we'll see you next week. Oh, I wanted to mention there's a new podcast app for iPhone. I don't know if it's on Android, but it's on iPhone anyway. It's called Breaker, and it seems to be really cool. It's like a social podcast app that allows you to see what your friends are listening to.
Wow.
So anyway, I'd recommend downloading that.
Sounds good.
And then also be sure to subscribe if you're not already subscribed. So thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone. And that's a wrap.